Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, going in-depth with the most interesting innovators, changemakers, business leaders, politicians, and activists in Vermont and around the country.
This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. And by National Life Insurance. For more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by over 1,000 VBSR members.
Here is noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. This week, we're going to take a journey to some of the most remote corners of the earth. My guest for the hour this week is Mark Jenkins, one of America's finest literary journalists on the subject of adventure and exploration. Mark is an international alpinist, a critically acclaimed author, a field staff writer for National Geographic, and the writer in residence at the University of Wyoming. Mark has spent his life seeking out and exploring the world's most remote wonders, from mountain peaks to isolated villages, dangerous rivers to war-torn nations. Some of his books include, or I should say, my Mark Jenkins book collection includes A Man's Life, Dispatches from Dangerous Places, To Timbuktu, A Journey Down the Niger, The Hard Way, Stories of Danger, Survival, and the Quest for Adventure, and Off the Map, Bicycling Across Siberia. Mark, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
David, it's great to be here.
It's a particular pleasure for me. Mark is an old friend and a writing inspiration. So great to have you here with us,
well,
Mark.
Well, back at you, David. I mean, we have been friends for a quarter century, I think. I remember the early days when we were both writing about cross-country skiing. I still write about it occasionally.
So I have been reading, and actually I was thinking as I was coming here, I think one of our earliest interactions consisted of, you were an editor at Cross Country Skier magazine, and you were particularly aggravated by having to sign a letter saying that I was on assignment to go to Patagonia to ski around Fitzroy and Cerritore, the mountain peaks in Patagonia. And you told me later that that was the straw that broke the camel's back, that you were going to be damned if you were going to be signing letters to send other people places that you wanted to go. And so I think you were not long for that job after that.
That was the end of my in-office career, the late 80s. I did it for 1 year outside of New York, where I was a managing editor, and then I went back to writing, and I haven't looked back. You're right. I just couldn't bear the fact that you were going someplace beautiful, and I was sitting in an office waiting for your story.
Well, we've all been enjoying the revenge you took circling the globe numerous times since. So, Mark, tell us a little bit of your own personal story. What led you to become the writer and explorer that you've gone on to be? Tell us about your family and where you grew up.
Oh, thanks, David, for asking. I'm the oldest of six kids. We grew up in Wyoming, but I think the seminal experience for our family was when my father got a sabbatical to Holland. And he took the whole family. Obviously, my mom and dad took all of us over there, put us all in Dutch schools. None of us spoke a word. A year later, we're fluent in Dutch and some French, a little German. And then we kind of went back to Wyoming. And after that experience, I left high school early, started traveling, hitchhiked across Europe and across Africa at the age of 18, came back, got a degree in philosophy at the University of Wyoming, and of course, I think I was about 2,000 years too late to get a job as a philosopher. I think Aristotle had the last one. So what do you do? You start writing, and I wrote about what I knew, which was adventure in the outdoors. I grew up in Wyoming hunting and fishing, and that kind of morphed into climbing and kayaking. And kept at it, writing for whomever would send me someplace in the world. I worked in Africa, I worked in Russia, kind of all over the world, really. And I had a long stint, almost a decade, as the columnist for Outside Magazine, which is an outdoor adventure magazine. And after that, I was hired by National Geographic. And I've been there for almost 7 years, covering adventure as well as geopolitics, everything from climbing Everest to, you know, covering landmines in Cambodia.
One of the hallmarks of your writing is that you are a participant observer. And it's one of the things that I find so engaging about your writing is that you're really telling us stories from the inside. You're not describing someone else climbing the mountain. It's you up there freezing and being terrified.
Right.
How does it change your perspective to be in the stories and really, a character in the story that you're reporting?
Well, I think it's interesting that you use the word character, because that is what happens. And this may be a little too literary for a radio, but really when you write a story, as you so well know, David, because I read all your work, is that you're capturing representative moments. I mean, I was on Everest for 3 months, and my story is a 15-minute read in National Geographic, right? So you have to capture those moments and those experiences, and really, you basically fictionalize nonfiction, because you just take everything down to these seminal moments. And you do that with yourself as well, because you end up becoming a character in your own story, as does everyone else. And this is always a difficulty, because you may choose 4 sentences from your climbing partner, for instance, to represent that entire person in your story. And of course, that's not who they think they are. And that's also true with your own character, is that you can only put in those parts of yourself, I feel, that have significance and substance for the story. So it is an interesting transformation, because when people read my work, I think they often imagine I am exactly who I am in my story. I am, insofar as everything I write is truthful or to the best of my ability, but it's also just a narrow slice. Just as when I have a character or a partner in a story, that's only a narrow slice of who they are. You can't really it's not real time, right? It's a condensation and a clarification of the experience.
Well, one of the risks that I'm sure you run is that in these situations of very intense experiences you'll have living with fellow climbers for 3 months, in the writing version of that story, you may not have the, your characterization of your comrades on that trip may not be flattering. Has that cost you some friendships, or at least some prolonged silences from people who you otherwise care about?
David, all of the above. Yes, I've lost friendships. That certainly has happened in some of my book writing, where I described people I'd met or people I traveled with in a way that they were very displeased. And prolonged silences, but also some it's fomented some great arguments about what was the point of why we were there. I think one thing to remember on any adventure is that each person is actually on that for a very private reason, and I know you've experienced this. Most of us who've done big expeditions realize this kind of partway through, that the reason you're there is not necessarily the reason that your partner or your companions are there. So you have to remember that whatever I write, and the reader, this is a hard thing for a reader to grasp, it's truly my perspective. The Everest story is a good example. If someone else on that expedition, Conrad Anker, for instance, were the leader of the trip, were to write the story, it'd be a very different story, because he's there for a different reason. I mean, we have a common goal, but it's often the case that during a trip, you find out that people are there for other reasons than what you thought they were there for.
Well, we keep circling around Everest here, so let's dive right in. This year is the 50th anniversary of when Jim Whittaker became the first American to stand atop Everest. It's also 1953, so that is the 60th year marks when Edmund Hillary became the first person with Tenzing Norgay, his Sherpa comrade, to stand atop Everest. You were sent by National Geographic to on an expedition in 2012. That is the cover story of the June issue of National Geographic this year. And let me just quote from your remarkable account of that. You write, "Everest has always been a trophy, but now that almost 4,000 people have reached its summit, some more than once, the feat means less than it did a half century ago. Today, roughly 90% of the climbers on Everest are guided clients, many without basic climbing skills. Having paid $30,000 to $120,000 to be on the mountain, too many callowly expect to reach the summit. A significant number do, but under appalling conditions. The two standard routes, the Northeast Ridge and the Southeast Ridge, are not only dangerously crowded, but also disgustingly polluted, with garbage leaking out of the glaciers and pyramids of human excrement befouling the high camps. And then there are the deaths. Besides the four climbers who perished on the Southeast Ridge, six others lost their lives in 2012, including three Sherpas. Clearly, the world's highest peak is broken, but if you talk to the people who know it best, they'll tell you it's not beyond repair." End quote. Well, that is not the the storybook version of Everest that people have grown up with, the fantasy version of Everest being the world's highest wilderness. And then there's the reality. So describe the reality that you found on Everest last year.
Sure. David, let me preface this by saying that I did go to Everest many years ago, 27 years ago. In 1986, I was a member of the U.S. North Face Expedition. And that's back in the 80s. There was no guiding on Everest. That didn't start until the early 90s. So in the 80s, I went with a small team of extremely experienced alpinists. We didn't summit, but for instance, we were the only ones at our base camp on the North Face. Today, if you're on the south side, that's the standard approach. The Nepal side, you go up the Khumbu Glacier. There are probably 900 people at base camp, at the Khumbu Everest base camp. There are maybe two to 300 climbers. 95% of really are guided clients, some of whom have experience, too many of whom just want to have a trophy. They want to say, "I climbed Everest," right? And so it's a different experience than it once was. Sherpas do so much of the heavy lifting. They carry most of the heavy packs. They go through the Khumbu Icefall, which is one of the most dangerous aspects of climbing the mountain, 30 to 40 times, whereas your average climber will only go through 8. They put in the camps. They put in the fixed lines that people, we say jug, but they're just sliding an ascender attached to a harness up the rope rather than using ice axe to pull themselves up. So it's a different world on the standard two routes. Now, I want to point that out because there are 15 routes on Everest, and almost everyone, I mean, literally, this, I think there were two people who attempted some other route last year. Almost everyone are on the two standard routes. There's one in China and there's one in Nepal. So those routes are heavily trafficked. They're very polluted. Base camp itself has been cleaned up, I should mention. The SPCC, the Sagamartha Pollution Control Committee, which is a kind of a city council for Everest Base Camp on the Nepali side, is forcing everyone to pick up their garbage, which is absolutely essential, and for all the outhouses to be fitted with plastic barrels, and that human excrement is taken down. But that doesn't happen at Camp 1, Camp 2, Camp 3, and Camp 4. So you have to remember, imagine any campsite, many of your listeners are campers, I think, and imagine any campsite that had allowed people to, you know, do one and two, shall we say, anywhere they wanted for 50 years. You would have a real mess, and that's what you have on Everest now. So there are fixes to this. First of all, the most of the human excrement needs to be removed and taken down. Second of all, what they need to do is require everyone who goes up on the mountain to use wag bags, which are just plastic bags that you crap in and you take your, you know, you remove it off the mountain. That's one thing needs to be done. There are lots of old fixed lines that need to be removed. There are bodies. And this is something that people disagree with me, but I don't think that it makes sense at this point to leave bodies high on the mountain. There was a time in mountaineering, and you probably remember this, it's only 20 years ago, in which the kind of custom was, well, if I die on the mountain, just leave my body there, right?
Right.
That still makes sense in very remote places, I think, where you're not going to have 300 people walk by your body. That doesn't make sense on Everest anymore. Really, I think we should build a little cemetery, believe it or not, at the South Col Camp at 26,000 feet and remove all the bodies that are on the mountain. We passed four that had died the week before, and we had three others that had been there for many, many years. Remove them to kind of this platform where you could bury the bodies with rocks and put some kind of symbol there. Rather than having climbers every year actually passing by frozen humans. I think it doesn't make any sense anymore. So I think there are fixes, but I think they need to be implemented. The Nepali government is somewhat disinterested in all of this, at least up to this point they have been, because they make an enormous amount of money off of people who go to climb Everest. Each climber pays the Nepali government $10,000 for a permit. So the Ministry of Tourism and Aviation last year made $3 to $4 million off of Everest climbers, and very little of that went back to Sagarmatha National Park. So they're reluctant to slow the numbers, first of all, and they're reluctant to institute any regulation because they're fearful that it'll slow the numbers. But this is a common problem with resources. There's a carrying capacity, and once you go beyond that carrying capacity, you start ruining the resource, and that's essentially what has happened on Everest in the last 10 years.
We're talking this week on the Vermont Conversation with Mark Jenkins, a writer for National Geographic and author of many books and an international climber and explorer. You can join this conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Well, Mark, you've talked about the responsibility that the Nepalese government bears. What about the responsibility that climbers themselves bear in this situation?
That's a great question, David. There is a very large difference between a client and a climber, and let me try to describe it. So often a client, their goal is the summit, and it's an unsuccessful trip if they don't reach the summit. That's not necessarily true with a climber. I mean, I have done expeditions that were some of my best trips ever, and we didn't reach the top because it was the experience, not necessarily the summit. The summit's great. I mean, you want to get to the top, but that's not the only reason to be in the mountains. For people who are clients, I think oftentimes it is. This isn't a lifestyle for them. After they climb Everest, they may never climb another mountain in their lives. In fact, I get asked that often. I mean, in slideshows, people say, "Well, now you've done Everest, are you quitting climbing?" And it's kind of a remarkable question because Everest is not the epitome for a mountaineer or an alpinist. It's just part of the evolution. And certainly, I mean, I climbed the Grand Teton for the fourth time last weekend. It's just a small little peak here in Wyoming. I'm going to the Wind River Mountains day after tomorrow to climb. So from a client's perspective, the experience matters, I think. I believe it matters much less than the summit. And from a mountaineer, a lifetime mountaineer, the experience matters more than the summit. So it's kind of inverted.
Talk a little bit about death in the mountains. You've told me in the past that at least the past statistics were something like only 1 out of 10 Himalayan climbers will not return from the trip. I don't know what that statistic is now. You have lost many friends in the mountains, including a very dear friend who accompanied you on, I think, your bike trip across Siberia, but your friend who died, who drowned in Greenland.
Yeah.
How has this affected you and your own approach to your journeys?
Well, it's a tough question, isn't it? Yeah, I have lost many close friends. The first thing I would say is when I talk to aspiring mountaineers, I want them to realize that mountaineering is a mortal sport, and that they need to think about how much they care about going into the mountains, because it's not basketball. You know, you're playing a game of a pickup basketball, you sprain your ankle, you get taken off the court, and all's well. If you do something really bad somehow and you break your ankle, the ambulance comes, you're in the hospital. You break your ankle high on a mountain, and it could be a death sentence. You might die from it. So it's a game. I guess you could call it a game, but it's a game with very serious consequences. And I think people need to think about that before they simply say, "Oh, I want to climb the Grand Teton, and then I want to climb the kind of the standard thing now for Americans." So often is, "I'm going to climb Rainier, and after I do Rainier, I'm going to go climb Denali, and after I do Denali, I'm going to Everest." Everest shouldn't be your third mountain. Everest shouldn't be your 30th mountain. it's something to think very long and hard about. So death in the mountains is part of what happens, and you, I believe you have to come to grips with it. And I've struggled with it a lot, being, as you know, a father of two daughters. I was fortunate enough to marry a woman who kind of understood my passion for extreme situations, but it's not for everybody, and it need not be. I mean, that's just fine. and you need to recognize that if you spend a life in the mountains, that accidents definitely will happen, and some people will die. It's the nature of the sport. It's a tough thing. I mean, you're asking me a very hard question, and I obviously don't have great answers. But I think you have to look in your soul and decide whether it matters enough to you to continue to do it. I really think you need to do that before something terrible or tragic happens.
How did you kind of do that calculus when the offer came to climb Everest, which statistically has been one of the deadlier mountains, but perhaps, as you point out, not for experienced climbers, but I'm not sure how that math.
Math is very complicated. Let me just say something about that before I identify the reasons that I went to Everest again. Everest has actually gotten safer because of the guiding, and this is kind of ironic, but more people go to Everest, but more people live through it. When I first went to Everest, you quote the 10% statistic, and that was pretty true. In the 80s, you had, if you were a summiter or somebody who went very high in Everest, above 26,000 feet, the mountain's 29,000 feet, you had a 10% chance of dying. I mean, that's worse than going to Vietnam. That's worse than being in World War II, so it was very risky. In the 70s, you had a 30% chance of dying. Now, today, 2013, you have about a 1% chance of dying on Everest. Why is that so? Well, first of all, the route has become very standardized. There are fixed lines everywhere. The weather has become a different issue. Everybody knows when the good weather patterns are coming. You're not just taking off guessing when the weather's going to get good. You actually have these highly sophisticated weather models that are being sent to you, faxed to you every 12 hours from Switzerland. And you've got all the Sherpa support. So the risk of climbing Everest have been dramatically reduced by guiding it. It's also reduced the experience, in my opinion, but the risks are lower. So when I was asked to go to Everest, I saw it as a great opportunity as a writer. And I didn't think too much about the risks. I mean, to be totally frank, I would say that mountaineering for me in my life is not the more risky sorts of assignments. Like going to the Congo and covering the war in the Congo That's riskier. Covering landmines in Cambodia, that's riskier. So, I mean, it's funny. It depends on your scale and your spectrum of tolerance of risk. In my world, mountains are, and I may die on a mountain this weekend, so I'll be caught out. But
Mark, we're going to have to take let's take a break there, and we'll pick it up on the other side of the news here in just a couple minutes and talk about your trips ahead.
Great.
Looking for a loan for your Vermont business, childcare, or nonprofit organization? Look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Because at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we lend to Vermont businesses and nonprofits, even if the bank says you're not quite ready for a loan. At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we focus on people, not profits. We'll work closely with you before and after you get your loan to make sure you get what you need to succeed. The Vermont Community Loan Fund makes loans to early stage companies and established businesses ready to take the next step. We lend to farms and food producers, high-tech businesses, manufacturers, retailers, childcare businesses, affordable housing developers, service providers, and other nonprofit organizations. We make loans to Vermonters doing business right here at home and around the world. So if you're looking for financing to help your growing business, look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Visit us online at investinvermont.org. That's investinvermont.org.
AP Update, I'm Rita Foley. Has the plot been busted up? Yemen's government says it stopped plots by Al-Qaeda to take over two cities in Yemen. There was also a plan to attack important ports and gas facilities, and that's been stopped as well. Yemen says these plots were disrupted as warnings were issued that led the U.S. and Britain to evacuate their embassies in Sana'a, Yemen's capital city. Our Mark Levie reports from overseas that U.S. drones have been targeting militants in Yemen with some success.
The drones fired missiles at two vehicles in southern Yemen, killing seven suspected Al-Qaeda militants. It's the fifth drone attack in Yemen in 2 weeks. It shows how seriously the U.S. takes the Al-Qaeda branch in Yemen.
In fact, Yemen has emerged as the focus of a feared attack that has led the U.S. to shut down temporarily 19 diplomatic posts in the Middle East and in Africa. AP Update, I'm Rita Foley.
Imagine your car's engine running without good maintenance. Now think of your heart. The Medicine Shop Pharmacy helps you take care of life's engine. With our 100% focus on health, we're your one-stop shop for health products, as well as the health information and advice you and your family depend on. It's all part of the Medicine Shop promise to provide the products, information, and personal service that you need to care for your health and your family's health with confidence. No wonder so many health-conscious people take the Medicine Shop Pharmacy to heart. The Medicine Shop Pharmacy, 100% pure pharmacy. South Main Street, Barry.
Agriculture is the heart of Vermont, and that heartbeat is alive and well at the Addison County Fair and Field Days, Tuesday through Saturday in New Haven. It's the largest agricultural fair in Vermont. Come and enjoy the Fair and Field Days with Feed Commodities International, blending quality with economy, committed to serving the farms in the Northeast. FCI is your partner in profitability. They're a great resource for farmers with news and information to help your business succeed. Feed Commodities International. Call them at 800-639-3191.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is pleased to make the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available.
This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow.
And the over 1,000 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. We are taking a trip around the globe this week with Mark Jenkins. He is an international alpinist, a critically acclaimed author, a field staff writer for National Geographic, and writer-in-residence at the University of Wyoming, and author most recently of a cover story on National Geographic called Maxed Out on Everest. Mark, let's pivot a little and go to another country you visited, Cambodia, which you wrote about last year in National Geographic. And there you were going not just to see the amazing ruins of Angkor Wat, the things that the Cambodia is known for, but kind of its underbelly, which is the fact that Cambodia is the most densely mined region of the world, as you write. You write that Pol Pot, whose regime was responsible for the deaths of some 1.7 million Cambodians between 1975 and 79, called landmines his perfect soldiers. And you write, they never sleep. They wait with limitless patience. Tell me a little bit about what you found when you went to Cambodia recently.
Right. I actually found a story of hope, believe it or not. It's a grim subject, but the story is actually called The Healing Fields, kind of a play off The Killing Fields, the movie of 20 years ago. Cambodia is one of the most sophisticated countries in the world in terms of dealing with its mine program. They've got demining force squads all over the country. They've got rehab centers for mine victims. They've got educational programs for grade school kids. I mean, you can go up to any five-year-old in Cambodia and they will tell you what a landmine is and what it looks like. So although it seems like a grim story, the numbers have dropped dramatically. Last year, less than 300 people were killed or maimed by landmines in Cambodia. 10 years ago, that number was 4,000. So they've really done a stunning job, and it's what will have to happen in other places that have extraordinary mine problems. Afghanistan is the next one on the list. In fact, I was motivated to write this story by being on assignment in Afghanistan and meeting families who'd lost children. Largely, it's children. You have to remember that landmines are not like bullets. They don't disappear when the war disappears. They're buried in the ground. So it's usually civilians, and it's typically women and children, often people out, farmers or herders, who are the victims of landmines. So landmines are a very different sort of form of warfare, and luckily the Ottawa Landmine Ban Treaty that was done in 1997, 157 countries have signed that. The U.S. is not one of them, although we've done enormous amount financially to help demine Cambodia and other countries. For instance, we have recently completely demined Nicaragua during our nefarious activities in Latin America 30 years ago, as well as El Salvador. We have paid to demine El Salvador. So landmines are a very gruesome and cruel form of warfare because they typically take the innocent and the young rather than soldiers.
What the U.S. is one of a handful of countries that hasn't signed the Mine Ban Treaty.
Right.
Among the others are North Korea and China. What could possibly be the rationale for wanting to preserve the right to use, you know, a weapon that maims people, mostly civilians?
Yeah. It's very convoluted. One of the things about signing the Landmine Ban Treaty is that you have to go back. First of all, you have to destroy all your stockpiles of landmines. And we've got stockpiles of all kinds of weapons across this country. I mean, it's very sick, in my opinion. We'd have to destroy those. The other thing you have to do is you have to try to track down where you have placed as a nation landmines and remove them. We have a sticky issue because we put a lot of landmines between North and South Korea in the mid or early 50s, 53, 54. And those landmines are still there. And if we were to sign the treaty, we'd have to go into that no man's land between North and South Korea and remove those landmines to live up to our treaty obligations. So that's one of the main reasons we haven't signed it. So this is not it's not atypical of large governments. China hasn't signed, Russia hasn't signed, U.S. hasn't signed. At least on the in the U.S.'s case, we have spent almost $2 billion over the last 20 years helping to demine countries, although we're still unwilling to give up any of our power to mine if we feel the need to do so. Supposedly, no mines were used in Afghanistan and Iraq. I'm not convinced, but very few were used. That's for certain.
Although, of course, IEDs, the notorious killer of both Iraqis and American soldiers, are really kind of just a variation on a theme of mines.
They sure are, yeah. And in fact, whenever you have weaponry anywhere in during a war, international or civil war, you're going to have IEDs because they are just improvised explosive devices. They take whatever you can find, whether it's used or, basically unused bombs or any kind of material, and you fashion landmines and you put them in on roads primarily. So, I wish, in fact, the Obama administration is reconsidering whether the U.S. should sign the landmine ban treaty. I think we should, obviously. I believe that this is the right thing to do. I believe it's the only way to move forward, and I think it would put the U.S. in this extraordinary position of leadership and goodwill to sign the treaty. Whether they do or not, I don't know.
We're talking this week on the Vermont Conversation with writer Mark Jenkins, a writer for the National Geographic and other places. Mark, you wrote a play about Cambodia. Was this your first foray into the world of theater, and what moved you to write it?
I'm not sure. I wrote the story, but the play was a short story to begin with, and it's basically about trying to understand a culture through the eyes of the Cambodians themselves. And so the play part, I didn't have anything to do. I was just writing a short story.
So the short story was fiction or not?
Yeah, fiction. I mean, I'm a nonfiction writer, but I still tend to write fiction here or there. It's a different type of an outlet. I mean, the constraints of magazine writing, as you know so well, are very real. And you're limited in space and you're limited in how... literary you can actually be. Magazines don't like it, so you have to keep it pretty tight. And I like the form of fiction where you have a lot more room. But I do it rarely. I mean, I make a living as a writer, and I go on assignment. That's what every two or three months I go someplace in the world, and I write. That's my job.
So one of your recent trips was a little different than others. You biked the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Vietnam, and on this trip, your travel partner was not a team of grizzled Himalayan veterans, but it was your wife, Sue.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about what's different about traveling on one of these trips with your spouse versus just the travel partners you've had.
Well, she's so much prettier, damn it, and she's tougher. So my wife and I have done lots of trips together, lots of adventures, climbing all over the world, bicycling all over the world, and so she's a very hardy woman, very capable person, and a great companion. This trip, we've done some very long bicycle trips, and we wanted to go to Vietnam, and I wanted to write about the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which was this kind of very famous jungle web of trails in the jungle. And we thought, why not bicycle through this? Because the bicycle was actually used by the North Vietnamese very effectively during the Vietnam War. And I wanted to follow that. And so, yeah, we were partners. We have been many times. And we also hired a kid, a 20-year-old, who's an interpreter. We brought a bike over for him, and he went with us. So in all cases now, I try to have an interpreter with me. I don't feel like I'm really getting what I need to get if I don't have someone there who can help me ask questions. So we bicycled the Ho Chi Minh Trail from Vinh all the way over into Laos, and then south through Laos, and then back into Vietnam. And we had our interpreter with us the whole time, and every village we stopped in, somebody had a story about the Vietnam War. And I did interviews along the way.
They call the American War there.
They call it the American War for good reason, right. I don't know how much you want to get into this, David, but the Vietnam War is something of a shameful experience, I think. Even conservatives nowadays will say, well, that was kind of a mistake. We lost 58,000 men, women, soldiers. But It was much bigger than that. It was kind of our own private holocaust, I have to say. The estimates now are between 1 and 2 million civilians were killed by American forces in Vietnam.
And
that's extraordinary. When you go there and you see it, and you see Agent Orange victims everywhere, you see amputees all over the place, they are still trying to recover from the Vietnam War, and we've kind of moved on, right?
We're talking this week with Mark Jenkins, a writer for National Geographic and other magazines and books. So as you traveled around Vietnam, Mark, to the degree that it's possible to characterize, the sentiment of a country, what were some of the themes that you encountered as you came to these villages and people recounted their war stories?
First of all, they were so ready to share. I mean, they just wanted to tell their story. Second of all, they were so hospitable and kind. Forgiveness is an amazing human emotion, and they've got that everywhere in Vietnam. We were welcomed into families. It was just an extraordinary experience, I have to say. They have moved on as best they can. Vietnam is a thriving economic place. You look in the back of your T-shirt, you probably see it. You know, you've got a T-shirt made in Vietnam or some other object. They have gotten back on their feet financially as a country. So the other thing that has to be remembered is that 75% of the people who now live in Vietnam were born after the end of the war. It's a very, very young nation. The average age is like 16 or something like that. So many people don't even remember the American/Vietnam War in Vietnam. They weren't alive. If you want to know what happened, you have to talk to the old people, and that's what I did. And it's not very hard to find them because they find you. With my interpreter, if we go into a village, you know, he'd just tell the local cafe owner that there's a writer interested in hearing about what it was like during the Vietnam War, and people would just show up. People missing limbs or blind or injured in some way would just show up and tell their story and explain how the war affected their family and themselves.
You describe meeting Ong Phun Minh, who was in charge of rerouting the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So just tell us a little bit about what the Ho Chi Minh Trail was then and is now.
Well, the Ho Chi Minh Trail now is kind of largely forgotten, and there is a Ho Chi Minh Highway. That's not the trail. The Ho Chi Minh Trail was built by the North Vietnamese to supply the war effort, obviously fighting the Americans, in southern Vietnam. And it wasn't really just one road. It was a network, a web of trails that went along the Trung Song Mountains, which is between Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. And they didn't have at that time the trucks, the tanks that we did, so they used bicycles. And people would often put 200, 300, 400 pounds on a bicycle. They were retrofitted with extra down tubes and seat tubes, and so they could carry enormous weight. And that's how they supplied their troops. And it was one of those kinds of miraculous sort of roads that was a network of roads that were maintained all the way through the war. And I let me just preface this by saying that I'm not a fan of the North Vietnamese nor the current government. The war had atrocities on all sides, so it wasn't as if and Ho Chi Minh himself was a ruthless person. I mean, he's credited with or accused of over 5,000 political killings of opponents. So he was not what we'd call a very kind leader. He was a very ruthless person. Nonetheless, the Ho Chi Minh Trail was this kind of forgotten web, and today it's just kind of gone back into the jungle. Some of them turned into highways, and some of them just kind of disappeared into footpaths. So we were on both. We were all on things that were actually highways, where you're on asphalt, all the way down to muddy tracks that are going right through the jungle, and you just appear in this bamboo village.
Now, it's the nature of explorations that sometimes when you go in search of something that's ephemeral, like, for example, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, that you get to these far-flung places and it doesn't really work out. You can't find the thing you came to find. Tell us about a disappointment or two that you've had upon arriving in one of the far-flung locales that you've gone to.
Oh, boy. That happens all the time. I don't know if I'd call them disappointments. I think I often think of them as revelations. I mean, so often you, as a writer, you'll pitch a story to a magazine and you'll say, this is what I'm going to do and this is what I'm going to find. And though you're making that shit up, as you know, I mean, you're not exactly sure. You've done all your homework. You've read the books. You've read the white papers from the UN. You've done all your homework that you possibly can. But when you get on the ground, things change. I think some of the most remarkable aspects of my expectations versus reality have been in Tibet. I've done 10 expeditions there, and one of the more recent ones, I went there to retrace the Tea Horse Road, which was a 1,000-year-old road that connected Tibet with central China, and the Tibetans would trade horses for the warlords, and the Chinese would trade tea. And so I wanted to travel part of this road via horse, by a Tibetan horse. And my wife went on part of this, one of the trips on this, and we got clear out in the sticks, and we found that they're not riding horses anymore. They're riding motorcycles. So we ended up riding the Tea Horse Road on the back of motorcycles rather than on horses. I think we as Americans, we like to imagine that there are places left in the world that are just so lost, that they're just left behind, right? And that they have no influence from the outside world. Well, that's really, really rare. And it's an extraordinary. I did do a trip in Papua New Guinea where we found nomads who were still living in caves, and that happens occasionally. But most of Africa, for the Americans, think of Africa like, you know, wild animals. They think of Africa and they think of the Serengeti. Now, Africa, as you know, and you've written about it yourself, is full of people everywhere. What we imagine the world to be, what we want the world to be, and what we imagine it to be, is often not connected to reality. It's connected to myths that we've read about, that we've believed in here in the U.S. And so that's the value of travel. If you want to know, this all comes back to it. The value of travel is to suddenly see the world for the way it is, not the way you wish it were. And that happens on every trip I go on. And I've done multiple trips around the world, many, many expeditions, over 100 nations. And every time I'm surprised. Every single time my expectations are blown away.
You've been critical of the dumbing down of adventure and the commodification of it as it's packaged, sold, logoized, etc., in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
What is adventure?
Well, the classic definition of adventure is an undertaking of unknown risk and danger. The reason I've been critical of that is I actually feel like the half of an adventure is basically planning it. And if you don't plan it yourself, you're missing out on a lot of the fun. For instance, people ask, I've had, you know, climbers ask, should I go to Everest? Hell no, don't go to Everest. Grab your buddy or a couple of them and plan, if you want to climb a mountain, first of all, go in your backyard. This is what I always say, go in your backyard. Have you actually hiked up the peak in your backyard before you decide to leave the state? Have you hiked or climbed in your own country before you go to some other country? So the reason I'm critical about kind of the package adventure is I don't really think it's adventure. You're not making decisions. In adventure, you make the decisions and you pay the consequences. And when it's all kind of outlined and figured out for you, that's not adventure anymore. That's just travel. And there's nothing wrong with travel, but don't call it adventure. Adventure is when things happen that are unexpected, that you really didn't know were going to happen, and then you got to think on your feet. You've got to be resourceful. You've got to keep a sense of humor. You've got to find a solution. And that doesn't happen in packaged events very much. I mean, it's all just kind of, it's packaged. You know what's going to happen the next day. You know what restaurant you're going to eat in. You know what hostel you're going to stay in or what bed and breakfast. That's not adventure. That's just travel.
Isn't that a little harsh, though? I mean, for somebody who grows up on a farm in Wyoming or Vermont and has never been out of their home state and they go to New York City, that's an adventure.
Yeah, I know. I've been criticized for that. Yeah, I know. I know. That's the kind of more open and forgiving approach to adventure. I still feel like I want to maintain the notion that adventure contains elements of surprise and unknown, where you have to solve a problem, solve a difficulty, get in there, and it's you doing it. It's not somebody else solving it for you. It's not a Sherpa carrying your pack, you carrying your pack. It's not a tourist guide taking you through New York. It's you actually arriving and making decisions on your own.
So tell me about one of the most harrowing moments on your many journeys.
We kind of got into this. I was going to mention that mountains I don't actually feel are tremendously dangerous. Mountains are relatively predictable, believe it or not, compared to humans. And so my most dangerous moments have always been with humans, not with animals, by the way. Animals are also relatively predictable. Grizzly bears to lions, to mountain lions. I've spent plenty of time with grizzly bears all over the place. They're relatively predictable. What's unpredictable is a 15-year-old boy with an AK-47. That's what's unpredictable.
And
that's where it's the most dangerous for a journalist.
And tell me about an encounter you've had that was especially nerve-wracking.
Oh, sure. I was several years ago, I was doing a story about the mountain gorillas in eastern Congo. And they were actually the mountain gorillas that were left in the Virunga National Park near Goma in eastern Congo were in the Makino sector of Virunga National Park. And the Makino sector was actually controlled by Rwandan insurgents. And so for me to find out whether there were really any gorillas left meant crossing enemy lines and getting into basically embedding with insurgents. And to do so required crossing a lot of dangerous country, including landmined roads, including bribing soldiers to allow them to for us to pass through. And then we were promptly just picked up and arrested by the insurgents and held by the insurgents. Eventually, they were informed by their commander that we actually were journalists, we weren't soldiers, and that we were there to see if the mountain gorillas were still alive, and they took us to this region and high in the mountains, high in the jungle, and the gorillas were still there. But that whole trip for a month with the kind of Rwandan-sponsored insurgents was very risky. I mean, you're around people with weapons all the time who are hot-headed, many of whom have been grown up in the most appalling situations, and murder is no big deal to them. It's an everyday occurrence, and so you have to be very careful that you don't end up being a victim.
So when you head out on a trip and you say goodbye to your wife and your two daughters, are you ever given pause at that moment?
Oh, sure. Sure I am. I mean, I'd have to be a stone if I... Yeah. And, again, I don't have any good answers for that, David. I think what I do is really very much about who I am as a person. And I need to go out to these places and write. That's very much who I am. And if I didn't need to do it, I don't think it would be worth it. I don't think it would be wise to do it. But it's the nature of my makeup, and so that's what I will always do. And fortunately, I have a very understanding wife and my daughters as well. They realize that's just Mark, and that's what he does for a living, and that's what he does for himself. So, yeah, I have lots of pause, but then I... kiss my wife and girls goodbye and go.
Okay, well, We've been talking this week on the Vermont Conversation with Mark Jenkins, a writer for National Geographic and a global explorer. Mark, thanks so much for taking us along on your journeys around the world this week.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thank you.
And that'll do it for this week's Vermont Conversation. We'll be back next Wednesday at 1 o'clock with another Vermont Conversation.
You have been listening to the Vermont Conversation with host David Goodman. Tune in next Wednesday when, once again, Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its over 1,000 VBSR members bring you David Goodman with this special program.
This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. And by National Life Insurance. For more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by over 1,000 VBSR members.
I'm Rita.